Hello and welcome to this week's Home is Where the Hearth Is podcast, where we're continuing our series on the philosophy of myth of J.R.R. Tolkien, Tolkien's philosophy of myth. And last week, as we began on the series, we were looking at Tolkien's famous essay, originally a lecture on fairy stories, and going through that. And to continue, he says, I don't know if I'm giving you page references or what have you, but if I was, I'm not going to now. Sorry. He says that fairy tales open a door on other time, capital O, capital T. They open a door on other time, and if we pass through, though only for a moment, we stand outside our own time. Outside time itself, maybe. Again, time capitalized there. So we might, of course, be thinking in maybe a specific sense of a wardrobe, for instance. C.S. Lewis's famous wardrobe, that when we walk through that, we emerge in another time and another place. The other place, of course, being Narnia. And there's no correlation between time spent in Narnia and time spent in our world. You know, and the same can be said, of course, of other fairy stories, both traditional and more modern. I mean, Lewis Carroll's Alice in Wonderland, Alice Through the Looking Glass, etc. But in a more general sense, of course, Tolkien takes us into this mysterious place, Middle Earth, just by opening the first page of The Hobbit or The Lord of the Rings. We don't have to walk through anything magical like a looking glass or a wardrobe to do so. But we are taken out of our time and out of our place into another mysterious time and place where perhaps truths can be learned more easily than they can in our own neighbourhoods. And then he talks about the great mythical significance of prohibition. Now, he's not, thanks be to God, talking about that silly idea in the United States 100 or so years ago when there was an effort to prohibit distilled and fermented beverages. I'm going to have a little sip of my gin and lime. By way of celebrating the fact that particular experiment in tyranny did not actually survive. But of course, this great mythical significance of prohibition is a different sort of prohibition altogether. Thou shalt not, or else thou shalt depart, beggared into endless regret. So of course, we cannot help but think as Christians of the Garden of Eden, of the Book of Genesis. Thou shalt not eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And the consequence of doing so is thou shalt depart from Eden, from our primeval prelapsarian paradise into the fallen, broken, miserable world, this land of exile and veil of tears in which we find ourselves. Or else thou shalt depart beggared into endless regret. And then he's one of my favorite aphorisms, if that's the right word, by Tolkien: the locked door stands as an eternal temptation. The locked door stands as an eternal temptation. Now, this is brilliant. Of course, this is, again, prohibition, but the locked door takes many forms. Of course, the locked door is the thou shalt not, in the sense of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, or Pandora's box would be another one. The ring, if you like, is a locked door. You may bear it, but you must not wear it. And prohibition, this thou shalt not, is an eternal temptation. And again, locked door is capital L, capital D, and temptation is capital T. Because the mystery of the thing, and the glory of the thing, and the suffering of the thing, the crucifixion of the thing, and the resurrection of the thing, is that God says, there is a locked door. Thou shalt not unlock it or open it, But then instantly afterwards, he says to us, here is the key. It's yours. The key is yours. You are free to open the locked door. You are free to succumb to temptation. You are free to use the key, but do not. And again, this is at the very heart of the mystery of free will, which is itself a heart of the mystery of love. If God creates us to love as he is, God is love, of course, then we must be free to choose to love. We have to be free to choose to voluntarily, in other words, by our own will, to freely choose to lay down our lives for the beloved. In other words, that love in a Christian understanding of things is a rational choice. You have to be subject to reason, which means only a fool would use the key. But of course, we have the right to be foolish. So we have the key. That's our freedom. That's our freedom to love or to refuse to love. It's our freedom to obey or not to obey. It's our freedom to sacrifice ourselves or our freedom to sacrifice others for ourselves. So this is, again, at the very heart of reality, the locked door, which stands as an eternal temptation. And it's only an eternal temptation because we have the key to open it. Now, if God said there's a locked door, you don't have the key and it's impossible to open, we wouldn't worry about it too much, presumably. But when we have the key in our hand, or around our neck, or in our pocket, it becomes a different issue. And again, you see the key perhaps being the ring, if we're talking in Tolkien terms. Then he goes on, the next section in this lecture is on children. And this is, again, Tolkien being just sublime and profound. In describing a fairy story which they think adults might possibly read for their own entertainment, reviewers frequently indulge in such waggeries as, this book is for children from the ages of 6 to 60. But I've never yet seen the puff of a new motor model that began thus. This toy would amuse infants from 17 to 70. Though that, to my mind, would be much more appropriate. Is there any essential connection between children and fairy stories? Again, this is Tolkien, in some sense, the Luddite, in the best sense of the word. Someone who is a techno-skeptic, basically saying for him, you know, the commercial for the new motor car is paying towards the childishness in the person who might buy it, and that somebody who's more interested in buying a new car and driving around it is much more infantile than someone who wants to read the profundities to be found and the mysteries to be found in great fairy stories. So for him, technology is more childish than literature. Let's move on. So he talks about Lang here, the compiler of fairy stories, Andrew Lang in Tolkien's own youth, a Victorian. Is it true is the great question children ask, Lang said. They do ask that question, I know, and it is not one to be rashly or idly answered. So children, again, asking childlike, not childish questions, in other words, profound questions, want to know if something is true. And of course, that begs the obvious question, quid est veritas, right? What is truth? Because, yes, of course, the great fairy stories enunciate great truths, but they might not be facts. And there's a difference. And G.K. Chesterton said once, not facts first, truth first. But here's a footnote that Tolkien appends to that comment. Is it true? He said, far more often they have asked me, was he good? Was he wicked? That is, they were more concerned to get the right side and the wrong side clear. That is a question equally important in history and in fairy, and indeed in life. again, Tolkien, of course, a father of four children, and we know that he read very often to all of his four children. He certainly had the experience of a paterfamilias, of a father of a family, as regards reading children's literature with children. And this is profound. Is it true? Yes, that's an important question, and we have to answer that question, quid est veritas, what is truth, carefully. But was he good? Was he wicked? In other words, the morality rather than the truth of something is perhaps even more important. We want to be on the side of the good, and ultimately the side of God, and not find ourselves fighting on the wrong side in that eternal struggle between good and evil. Children have great wisdom. And then carry on. This is Andrew Lang, a quote from Andrew Lang. Their taste remains like the taste of their naked ancestors thousands of years ago, and they seem to like fairy tales better than history, poetry, geography, or arithmetic. So that's the quote from Andrew Lang, but Tolkien objects. But do we really know much about these naked ancestors? Except that they were certainly not naked. At this point, by the way, before we carry on, for those of you that haven't read G.K. Chesterton's The Everlasting Man, first of all, you should do, but this is quite clearly, to me, proof that Tolkien had read it, because the whole argument in the beginning of that book, of the man in the cave, really is the most profound case against chronological snobbery, looking down our noses at our ancient ancestors that I've ever known. That Chesterton says in that the only evidence we have of the man in the cave is that he was an artist, which makes him very akin to us, and certainly not chasms apart as scientistic people might and chronological snobs might suggest. So again, Tolkien encapsulates this. What do we really know about these naked ancestors, except that they were certainly not naked? So even the very first thing we presume about them, their nudity, the fact that they did not have clothes, is a betrayal of our snobbery, which Tolkien exposes. Our fairy stories, however old certain elements in them may be, are certainly not the same as theirs. Yet if it is assumed that we have fairy stories because they did, then probably we have history, geography, poetry, and arithmetic, because they liked these things too, as far as they could get them, and insofar as they had yet separated the many branches of their general interest in everything. Again, profound from Tolkien, that basically the fairy stories, a love for fairy stories, a love for stories in general, is something which is part of the very fabric of what it is to be a human person. Something the humanities are basically an expression of our humanity. So yes, we would want stories. Our ancestors, as far back as we want to go, would want stories. But yes, they would also want history. They would be interested in what the elders of the village told them about the elders that they remembered, and what things were like two generations earlier. Three generations earlier, so history was part of it. Geography, they would want to know about the man who travelled, 80, 90, 100 miles and came back and told stories about what it was like. So in England, if someone headed north from southern England, they'd talk about the hills and the mountains and the moorlands. Geography, poetry, that yes, we've sung songs, we've praised the goodness and beauty of life and of nature with words since the beginning. And arithmetic, yes, we've for the first time somebody had to distinguish between how many sheep they owned, or how many sheep they're going to give to somebody else, and how much that would leave them. Part of the very fabric of who we are, arithmetic, mathematics. So all of these things, broadly speaking, the humanities are part of the very fabric of humanity itself, and fairy stories is just one part of that general humanity. That's as far as we've really got in the 15 minutes we spend on these podcasts. I could see this series on the Tolkien's philosophy of myth going on for several more weeks. So until next time, please do join me again next week for the next in this series of Tolkien's Philosophy of Myth. Until then, goodbye and God bless.